Welcome back to Baptist Basics University. You are listening to the course on the Gospel of John. This is lesson number 23 in that series. And today's lesson, we will be talking about Lazarus. A very famous story from the book of John. We'll be in chapter 11. We'll be covering verses 1 through 46. Now, this miracle is an amazing miracle. It's one that we know a lot of details about. It's also one that was performed on a very close friend of Christ, which makes it a little bit more unusual. There's a lot of very unusual things about this miracle. I believe this is the greatest miracle Christ performed. It's one that could not be faked. It's one that had a tremendous impact on Christ's ministry. In fact, this miracle was so effective in bringing people to Christ that the chief priest in the latter part, actually it's I think it may be the next chapter, but the chief priests are actually planning on putting Lazarus to death along with Christ. That's how powerful this miracle was among the Jews. I believe this is the greatest miracle performed by Christ outside of what he would do on the cross. But just the miracles inside his ministry, I believe this is the greatest one he performed. Now, he did raise three people up from the dead. There was a young girl and a boy. He actually broke up the funeral on that one. But this one is just amazing because how long he'd been dead. Lazarus has been dead for days. It's not just hours. You know, you can't say he swooned. Even if he had been alive, he probably would have suffocated inside that tomb. I mean, there's no way this could be faked. And you look at it, I mean, nobody could deny it, what had happened here. Now, it's amazing, though, this is pretty much his last miracle. I mean, he's going to heal the high priest servant's ear. Was it Malchus was his name, I believe. And that's his last miracle before they tie his hands, and, you know, great mess is there. They bind his hands, and that's the last miracle he ever did. But this is one of his last ones. The cross is fast approaching. He is very soon to die. I mean, we're talking months away at this point. But this is the ultimate of miracles. Turning water into wine is amazing. Feeding thousands of people with a few loaves and a few little fishes, that's amazing. Calming a storm, that's amazing. But raising a dead person is beyond impossible. This miracle is unmistakable. It's irrefutable. It's his last major showing, the last major miracle, the last major showing of Christ's power before the cross. This is really the last major display and the last opportunity through showing his power. Kind of his last outreach, major outreach to the Jews to accept him was through this miracle. Now, to set the story, Jesus is away, probably near the place called Annon, which is up on the Jordan River, about, I think it's 20, 30, 40 miles, something like that. I don't remember exactly, but I think it's about 40 miles, if I remember right, north of Judea. He's kind of in between Samaria and Perea to the east and Judea to the south. So he's kind of surrounded in this kind of no man's land, culturally speaking and religiously speaking. And he's there away from the Jews because the Jews are ready to kill him, the Jewish leaders. Mary, Martha, and Lazarus are all siblings. They're friends of Christ. They live in the town of Bethany. Bethany is about 2 miles from Jerusalem. If you just leave Jerusalem and take out going east and climb over the Mount of Olives and come down, you're in Bethany. It's very close to Jerusalem. In fact, a lot of people believe this is a place where Christ would stay when he came to Jerusalem, because there's no record of Christ spending a night in Jerusalem other than during the trials before his death. So this probably was a place he retreated. He was very close to this family. We don't know just a whole lot about this relationship, but we know he was very close to all three of these individuals. You can tell just in his interactions with them that he was very close. These may have been the closest friends he had on earth, even including his disciples. He was very close to this family. Now, I don't want to get into any kind of legend stuff about who they were, and there's some stuff about that their dad was Simon the leper, who threw a big feast for Christ, and there's some evidence that, you know, when you compare verses, that's very possible. But I don't want to get into all that. We're just going to deal right into this, because this is a lengthy passage we're going to deal with, and I just kind of want to get through it. And it's a very obvious story. There's not a lot of stuff we're going to get into. We're going to stay pretty close to the story on this one. As I say, for nothing else, just to get it done. It actually took me 2 weeks to get through this in my Sunday school lesson. So we see in John chapter 11, verses 1 and 2. Now, a certain man was sick, named Lazarus, of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. And it was that Mary which anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. It's amazing, verse 2, it's in parentheses there. That hasn't happened yet. We're actually going to cover that in the next lesson. But that doesn't happen until the next chapter. That's still actually a few months away. But that's what Mary was famous for doing. So, and evidently was well known that she's the one that did that, because John makes a point of clarifying which Mary this is, because there was, I think, five or six Marys is what they say in the Bible. So he's clarifying which Mary this is by what she did she was famous for. And of course, that hasn't happened chronologically yet, but that's what she was famous for. So we have the place to set. We have Lazarus of Bethany, who's, of course, in his family, Mary and Martha. And Lazarus is very sick. He's at the point of death. Verse 3. Therefore his sisters sent unto him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom thou lovest is sick. That's an amazing statement there. He whom thou lovest. They don't have to say who he was. He just gets the letter, or maybe the servant brought it. Let's just imagine it's a letter. It may not have been. Maybe a servant just, carried word. But let's just say it was a letter. So the servant arrives and hands Jesus the envelope, and he looks, and the return address says, Mary and Martha, Bethany, Judea. And he's, oh, wow, hey, it's for my friends. He opens it up and says, and it doesn't even say his name. It says, he whom thou lovest is sick. He doesn't have to wonder about who it is. They don't have to say Lazarus is sick. He knows who they're talking about here. So evidently he had a very close relationship with Lazarus. And it seems like he had a very close relationship with his entire family. So verse 4, when Jesus heard that, he said, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified thereby. So Jesus is telling the disciples flat out what's going to happen. He's saying, look, the sickness is not unto death, which is funny because he's going to die. He's not going to stay dead. But there's a purpose to this. That purpose is for the glory of God, the Son of God might be glorified thereby. Jesus knows what he's going to do. Jesus knows what's going to happen. A lot of this is strange, and people wonder, why did you wait so long? Why did he tarry? Mary and Martha were wondering, why in the world did he wait so long? Jesus had a purpose. He knew what he was going to do. He knew he was going to raise Lazarus. He knew Lazarus had to die. He knew Lazarus had to stay dead for a few days. He knew this was going to be the greatest miracle he performed. It had to be set up that way. And imagine this. To me, this is... If you've watched very many Westerns, I like old Western movies. There's usually not anything dirty in them. You get those, the old, like Roy Rogers, type Westerns. You know who the bad guy is, you know who the good guy is, and the good's going to win at the end. They're just great. You can predict them, but anyway, I don't want to get into all that. But like in a movie like that, you'll have the hero, and he's trapped out in the desert, and he's surrounded by Indians, and they're about to close in, and it looks like all hope is lost, and then right there you hear the bugle call, and here comes the U.S. cavalry, and they come riding in and save the day. Well, if the cavalry had came in 5 minutes before, it wouldn't have been as dramatic, but just right before they're about to kill our hero, here comes the cavalry. Basically, that's kind of what Jesus is doing here. He's waiting for the last minute. It's setting up to be the perfect climax. He's setting this up for, it's set up to be dramatic, to get people's attention. He's not going to go and do a Benny Hinn, you know, slap him in the head and breathe on him and Lazarus is going to come back to life. No, this is going to be something like no other miracle. This is going to be beyond doubt. This is going to be the kind of thing that is going to spread like wildfire. That's the purpose of this. It's to get the word out. I think this may be the last overture to the Jews, major overture. It's the last major display of his power. But this is set up to show how big God is and how powerful Christ is. There's going to be no doubt that he is the Messiah, that he is God. Verse 5. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Of course, they were very close. Verse 6, and when he had heard, therefore, that he was sick, he abode 2 days still in the same place where he was. So he gets word, hey, he's sick, he's about to die, and ho-hum, let's hang around a couple more days. And so we see that went over well. Verse 7, then after that saith he to his disciples, let us go into Judea again. So after 2 days, he says, okay, boys, hey, let's get going down there. We got to go check on Lazarus. Now, maybe the disciples had taken him at his word. You know, he says, oh, he's not going to die. They probably trusted him. And, they don't know why they wouldn't. So, I don't think that they really realize what's going on either. In verse 8, his disciples saying to him, Master, the Jews of late sought to stone thee, and goest thou thither again? It's like, hey, Jesus, you remember what happened in chapter 10? It just happened in the previous chapter. It wasn't that long ago. We just talked about it in our last lesson. They tried to kill you, and we're going to go back down there? Are you okay? Are you thinking straight? Maybe you've been out in the sun too long. What's going on? So they really kind of questioned Jesus' move. And verse 9, Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours in the day? If any man walk in the day, he stumbleth not, because he seeth the light of this world. So basically, Jesus there, in a very flowery way, a very picturesque way, saying, look, I know what I'm doing. You know, hey, I'm doing the will of God. You know, I'm not going into this blindly. I know what's going to happen. Just trust me. Verse 10, but if a man walk in the night, he stumbleth, because there is no light in him. So I think Jesus kind of talking about how grave the situation is here, how dark it is. It's kind of comparing to the previous verse, but you know, it kind of looks like these verses are out of place, but basically what Jesus is pointing to in these two verses is saying, look, you know, I'm the light of the world, and you walk in my light, and you're not going to stumble, and you're just going to have to trust me. I think that's kind of what he's getting at in those two verses. It's kind of difficult to follow because they seem so out of place. Verse 11, these things said he, and after that he saith unto them, so Jesus is now going to break the news to them, just to let them know what's going on. So he saith unto them, our friend Lazarus sleepeth, but I go that I may awake him out of sleep. So Jesus tries to tell them, you know, if you've ever been with somebody who tries to do something very tactfully and then nobody gets it, so then they have to come out and be very blunt, that's what's going to happen here with Jesus. As I always kid around and say that the disciples were the three stooges times four. And it's one of those cases, they don't get it. You know, they're a little slow like we are most of the time. Verse 12, then said his disciples, Lord, if he sleep, he shall do well. So it's like, well, hey, if he's sleeping, that's good. Sick people need their rest. And if he's sleeping, he's recovering. That's good. That's good that he's sleeping. So I can imagine, verse 13, Jesus kind of slaps his head and, you know, think, boy, they don't get it again. Here we go again. Howbeit, Jesus spake of his death, but they thought that he had spoken of him taking of rest and sleep. So verse 14, then said Jesus unto them plainly, Lazarus is dead. So he finally has this, boys, you don't get it. Let me just tell you, he's dead. Verse 15, and I am glad for your sakes that I was not there. So he's like, look, he's not saying it's for Lazarus' sake. It'd been better if Lazarus hadn't died. You know, Lazarus hadn't been sick. That'd been best. But this wasn't for Lazarus. This was for the people. This was for the disciples. This wasn't about healing Lazarus. This was about spreading the word about the Messiah. This was about proving Christ's deity. To the intent ye may believe, so that's the purpose that you'll believe. Nevertheless, let us go unto him. So, all right, let's go. So verse 16. We have the famous disciple Thomas. What's Thomas famous for? Doubting, right? Well, here's the other thing Thomas said. Verse 16, then said Thomas, which is called Didymus, which means the twin, I believe, if I remember right, unto his fellow disciples, let us also go that we may die with him. So most people do. There's two ways to go with that. He could be just like, oh, great, now we'll just go down there and die and kind of cast off. But I like to think positively about people. I think Thomas was just very boldly saying, look, if Jesus is going, I'm with Jesus. I don't care if we die or not. I'm staying with Jesus. I think that's what he was saying there. And I've heard different people say different things, but that's what I like to think positively about people. So I think Thomas was doing good here. So all that, you know, is just to get Jesus to Bethany. In verse 17, Jesus is going to get there. Then when Jesus came, he found that he had lain in the grave 4 days already. So it's with the time the message got to him, and Jesus waited 2 days before leaving, and by the time he had traveled all that way, and I mean, walking, it was going to take some time to get down there. I mean, there wasn't a bus to catch or a train or a plane, wasn't even an automobile, and I mean, Jesus didn't get a swift horse and go riding. From what we know, the only time Jesus really ever rode on an animal was during the triumphal entry. So Jesus probably just took off walking. That's basically the way everybody traveled back then. Even if you had an animal, usually they had all your stuff on their back and you just led them along. So he gets there, and with all that travel and stuff, it's been 4 days since he's been buried. So he's been dead over 4 days, probably not quite 5 days, because what would happen with the Jews usually is they would bury you pretty quick, usually within 12 to 24 hours, because, you know, hey, things start happening and it gets unpleasant around dead body. They start stinking. So usually once somebody died, you would prepare the body, and then, you know, they would wrap it up kind of like a mummy, and they would pack it. They would clean it and pack it with spices. You know, they didn't, you know, do like the Egyptians and pull out the brains and stuff like that. But they would pack spices, usually, you know, kind of rub it, anoint the body, keep it smelling good through everything. And they would pack those spices and stuff even inside the wrapping, just to kind of keep it smelling good for the main reason. And basically they would lie in the house for some time, and usually by sundown they would be in the graves. You know, if you died during the night, by the next Sunday, they usually didn't stay out of the grave. It's not like nowadays, you know, where 3 days later there's a funeral. It didn't go that long. So he's been dead 4 to 5 days at this point, because he's been buried 4 days. And verse 18, now Bethany was nigh to Jerusalem, about 15 furlongs off, and that's about 2 miles if you want to convert all that. Verse 19, and many of the Jews came to Martha and Mary to comfort them concerning their brother. Now, Jewish funerals were big deals. They almost turned into a big production. You had a lot of mourners. In fact, they had paid mourners. They had professional mourners even. Not just did you pay people to cry at your funeral, but they had people that did that for a living. They were just good criers and good wailers, you know. But, I mean, these were major events. They did a lot of mourning and crying and wailing and stuff. And people liked it. I guess, you know, the more you were cried about at your funeral, the more everybody thought they liked you. So, kind of almost was a social event, I guess you could say. But, I mean, it was a pretty big production, and they would, you know, have the procession out and bury the body in the tomb and such. And well, before we get there, the tombs that they normally had. Now, there's different things they would do for tombs. The rich people would have little caves carved out into the hillside, and their bodies would be laying in there on shelves, and then they would seal it, usually roll a big millstone looking rock, which you're probably very familiar with. That's the Joseph of Arimathea's tomb that Christ laid in was like that. And what they do is lay the bodies in there and then close it and seal it up. And, you know, they'd open it back up when they need to stick somebody else in there. Now, of course, you can imagine with a system like that, it's, and then they would do other things too. They actually would build a little house. You know, some of the rich people would build like little buildings, you know, kind of like a mausoleum type deal. But you can imagine space is at a premium. So you had a family tomb, and a lot of times what they would do is actually go in there, you know, once your body had, you know, kind of rotted away and there wasn't much left, they would actually kind of sweep you up and put you in a box and go and like rebury the box. And that's kind of how they kept grave space going. Now, the poor people, they actually were just buried. You know, it wasn't as big a production. They didn't have as much money to spend. And then the kind of the refuse of society, the beggars and lepers and such, actually their bodies kind of got thrown in with the landfills a lot of times. From what we read, the landfill they had, I believe it was called Gehenna, which, you know, they actually compared to hell. That's the reason why that word was used. Because of the fires and stuff they're burning there, they actually would just go dump beggars in there. But we're going. Lazarus and his family are very well off. He's going to be buried into a cave, one of these cave graves. So where were we at? I got sidetracked in that. Verse 20. Then Martha, as soon as she heard that Jesus was coming, went and met him, but Mary sat still at the house. So Martha's very practical. Mary's a lot more emotional. So Martha just immediately, hey, Jesus is coming, I'm going to go see her. And Mary's, she's just too tore up, she's not going to go yet. So verse 21, then said Martha unto Mary, Lord, if thou hadst been here, my brother had not died. I don't think she's being, I don't think this is an accusation. I think she's just a fact, like, oh, if you had just been here, I wish you'd have been here, you could have done something. I don't think it's like, if you'd have been here, he wouldn't be dead. She wasn't blaming him. I think she's just pointing out a fact. Verse 22, but I know that even now, whatsoever thou wilt ask of God, God will give it to thee. So it shows Martha has a lot of faith in Christ, because even at this point, she's saying, look, whatever you ask of God, God's going to do. Verse 23, Jesus saith unto her, thy brother shall rise again. Bold statement there. Verse 24, Martha doesn't get it. Martha saith unto him, I know that he shall rise again in the resurrection at the last day. She's like, yeah, I know, yeah, the... Later on, you know, God's going to come. We're all going to be resurrected. You know, I know. You know, the grave's not the end of it. We're going to live forever. I know that. Verse 25, and Jesus said unto her, I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. So, Jesus is the resurrection, personified. Now, he's going to resurrect himself. He's going to resurrect others. But he's also the source. He's also the reason why there can be a resurrection. He is the one that defeated death. And not only did he defeat death, he is life. So he is Lord of the living and the dead. And, of course, he is that dividing line. He that believeth in me, the dividing line between the saved and the lost. Though he were dead, yet shall he live. So it's like, look, no matter what shape they're in, as long as they believed in me, they're saved, they're going to live. Verse 26, and whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die. Believest thou this? He points out, look, you know, if you believe in me, you're going to be saved. You'll never die, not physically, but spiritually. And he said, look, Martha, don't you believe this? And she said, verse 27, she saith unto him, yea, Lord, I believe that thou art the Christ, the Son of God, which should come into the world. That is almost as profound as Peter, when Peter was pressed, and he said, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. I mean, that's right up there with it. Those two statements may be the most profound testimonies given by people as to who Christ was. These people got it. Martha got who Jesus was. In verse 28, when she had so said, she went her way and called Mary her sister secretly, saying, the Master has come and called for thee. Funny thing there, did Jesus call for her? I don't know. I think Martha just said, look, you know, Jesus just helped me. I think Mary needs some help too. So I don't know. I don't know if she's making that up or not. Maybe Jesus did. It's just not recorded. And verse 29, as soon as she heard that, she arose quickly and came unto him. So now Martha's back at the house. Now Mary, now picture this. Jesus hasn't even got to town yet. Evidently, he's still outside of town. He hasn't even got to their house yet. And we'll know that when we get into here. In fact, verse 30 here. And now Jesus was not yet coming to town, but was in the place where Martha met him. So she must have went out and met him, you know, outside the town at the well, or, you know, you know, whatever there was out there, the meeting place, the rest stop. I don't know what it was. And so Martha has gone back to her house. Now Mary goes out to meet him. And verse 31, the Jews then, which were with her in the house and comforted her, when they saw Mary, that she rose up hastily and went out, followed her, saying, she goeth unto the grave to weep there. So, nope, they didn't hear Martha tell Mary to go see Jesus. So they just thought, oh, she's getting up to leave and she's upset. She's going to the grave. Let's go too. You know, these were those mourners I was talking about. Some of these probably were professional mourners. They were getting paid, you know, a few shekels to cry and mourn. This just custom. I guess back there, you know, in those days, you know, funerals were a big deal. I mean, maybe the only time you got together, you know, make the most of it. So there's a bunch of Jews there, and they're mourning and comforting Mary. And it's funny, Martha didn't have those people go with her. So I think Mary was the one that was very emotional. I think Martha was just down to business. Verse 32, then when Mary was come where Jesus was, she saw him. She fell down at his feet, saying unto him, Lord, if thou hadst been here, my brother had not died. Does that sound familiar? Yeah, Mary said, Martha said the same thing. And once again, I don't think that she's accusing or blaming. I think she's just pointing out a fact. In verse 33, Jesus therefore saw her weeping, and the Jews also weeping, which came with her. He groaned in the spirit and was troubled. Now, of course, we know what this is leading up to here. Verse 34, and said, where have you laid him? They said unto him, Lord, come and see. Verse 35, Jesus wept. Jesus was human. Now, he was God too. But Jesus had emotions. And he is moved with compassion for these loved ones he has who are upset. He's also mourning the spiritual state of the people there. He knows what's going to happen. I mean, why is he crying? He knows what's about to happen. He knows he's going to raise Lazarus. But yet he's so moved by the situation and by those around him that he too is troubled in his spirit and upset, and even that he wept. And boy, isn't it wonderful to have a God that understands? Isn't it wonderful that has a God who understands him? He's not detached from us, but he loves and cares for us and wants to be there for us, and that our troubles trouble him. Isn't it good to have a God that is with you, that understands, that partakes of those same things Jesus went through all the things we went through, we go through. But isn't it good that even though he's back up in heaven, he's still attached to us. He still loves us, and he still cares for us. He's not detached. He's not complacent about what he takes part in what we feel and what we go through. Well, I haven't even been looking at my outline. I've just been going through here. Let me get back to where I'm going. So Christ is moved by compassion on these mourning people. And now we're going to see the varied reaction of the people. Verse 36, then said the Jews, behold how he loved him. So I think they're like, oh, wow, Jesus loved this man so much. We've never seen Jesus cry like this. Wow, he must have really loved Lazarus. Verse 37, and some of them said, could not this man, which opened the eyes of the blind, have caused that even this man should not have died? Now, this, I think, they are blaming Christ. I think they are saying, well, if he really cared, if he really was the Messiah, he'd have come here and done something about this. So I think you have these people who in verse 36, who are moved, who I think trust Christ. And then verse 37, we have those that don't. And I think that you have the verse 36 of the people sympathetic to Christ, and verse 37 are those that are antagonistic towards Christ. So I think we have two groups of people represented in those reactions. So now we've been with Christ from on his way to Bethany. We've been to him just outside Bethany. And now we're going to wrap up here in this last 8 or 9 verses. He's finally at the grave. He's come now to the place where Lazarus lay. Verse 38, Jesus therefore, again groaning in himself, cometh to the grave. it was a cave, and a stone lay upon it. So let's say it was one of these caves in the rock, and they had it sealed up. They had the stone covering up the door. Verse 39, Jesus said, take ye away the stone. And can you imagine, you know, usually what they do is go up to, you know, and sit outside and cry and mourn. But Jesus walks up, and I think he's still crying and weeping. He looks at Martha and says, open it up. You know, take away the stone, open it up. And Martha is really puzzled. Martha, the sister of him that was dead, saith unto him, Lord, by this time he stinketh, for he hath been dead 4 days. So it's like, listen, you know, after about, you know, it doesn't take very long for the body to start stinking. They say after 3 days it's pretty bad. But it's like, Jesus, he's been in there 4 days. It's not going to be pretty. It's, you know, he's going to be deteriorated. It's going to stink. You don't want to do this. So, verse 40, Jesus saith unto her, said I not unto thee, that if thou wouldest believe, thou shouldest see the glory of God? Now, I like this. A lot of times, Jesus' miracles hinge on the actions of an individual. He almost leaves it up to them. It's like, do you really want me to do this miracle? Would he have fed the multitude had not the lad given him the bread and loaves? In this case, he looks and he's like, you know, if Martha said, Jesus, you're crazy. We ain't opening that door. We ain't opening that stone up. No, no, no. We ain't doing it. It ain't proper. It stinks. We ain't doing it. It's gross. Would Lazarus have been raised? No, he left it up to her. So I think he'd already pretty much told her, you know, when you look at ways he kept telling her, I'm the resurrection, you know, your brother's going to live again. Don't you trust me? And so I think maybe she had an idea of this, but this wasn't what she expected. So he kind of lives it up to her. So it's like, you know, so he says, said unto thee, if thou wouldest believe, thou shouldest see the Son of God. So I think everybody kind of looks at Martha. It's like, they don't look at Mary. I think Mary was the emotional one. She's bananas. And Martha's calm and level-headed, and I think she's the take-charge person here. So I think everybody looks at her, and Martha says, well, if Jesus asks it, you know, go ahead. So verse 41, then they took away the stone from the place where the dead was laid. So they open up the grave. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank thee that thou hast heard me. So they open it up, and Jesus then begins to pray. And, of course, it says lift up his eyes, so he's looking up into heaven. A lot of people picture him with his hands outstretched, you know, and very dramatic. But Jesus looking up and cries out to the Father, says, I thank thee that thou hast heard me. So I think, you know, he already knows what's going to happen. Him and the Father are on the same page and know what's going to happen. Verse 42, and I knew that thou hearest me always. So, I mean, listen, there was no doubt about with Christ about the relationship of Christ and the Father, the Son and the Father. But because of the people which stand by, I said it, that they may believe that thou hast sent me. There's the purpose right there of this miracle of what's going on. This was to be a mighty display of God's power, a mighty proof of Christ's messiahship. Verse 43, and when he thus had spoken, he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. Now, I like the person that, or a preacher that said one time, he had to be singular here and say Lazarus, because had he just said come forth, all the graves would have burst open. One of these days that's going to happen, by the way. But he had to be singular. Lazarus, you come forth. In verse 44, and he that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot with grave clothes. So they wrapped him up kind of like a mummy. They'd wrap each finger individually, then wrap the hand. And I think they're pretty much bound all together, you know, kind of like a mummy, just in one. It ended up being bound all the way up in kind of one big mass. And bound with grave, and his face was bound about with a napkin, so that napkin still over the face. And of course now they would lay that over the face, that, and that's also of course going to be, you will see that again when Jesus raises from the dead, that napkin comes back into play. And Jesus saith unto them, loose him and let him go. So can you imagine this? Everybody's going out there, all these people have been mourning, and Jesus just broke up their little pity party. Jesus, they all go out there expecting just to cry, and all of a sudden this has just turned into an amazing, amazing event. And now we're going to see the reactions of the people, verse 45. Then many of the Jews which came to Mary and had seen the things which Jesus did believed on him. That was the purpose of this miracle, was that people would believe on him. Listen, if I saw a man raise somebody else from dead, I think I'd listen to anything they said. You know, that's just, you know, if they can do that, they can probably do a whole lot of other stuff. And so I think, you know, they immediately just, oh my goodness, we had reservations, but if he can do that, he has to be the Messiah. So some people believe on him, verse 46. But some of them went their ways to the Pharisees and told them what things Jesus had done. So the second group we see are the tattletales. They're the spies, and they went back to tell the rulers back at Jerusalem, fellas, we're in trouble now. You won't believe what he just did this time. So we have these two groups, those that believed and those that rejected. Once again, an allusion to the two groups, the saved and the lost. The dividing line is Christ. We have those that believed and those who were going to seek to destroy him. And that'll lead up into our next lesson, where we'll really get into the plans of the Pharisees and the Jews. But what an amazing story. One of the most famous, often quoted, and so many times sung about and alluded to. I mean, this story is so amazing. And what an amazing, mighty miracle. I'll say this, to me, is the greatest miracle Christ performed. But the God that can raise a dead man can also raise a dead man spiritually. And that Jesus' purpose wasn't come to bring dead people back to life. It was bring those dead spiritually back to life. That was his purpose. That we who are dead in trespasses and sin might be revived back to life and come to know life through the work of Christ. If we'll just heed that call. Because Christ will call, when you've got the gospel, the Holy Spirit calls out to you and by name. I mean, it's personal. And the Holy Spirit cries out to you and says, won't you believe? And when we accept that, it's just like Lazarus. We become a new man. We raise up out of the depths of death and hell to newness of life. That was what Christ's purpose was about. Now, the miracle was the raising of a dead man physically, but it was to point people to the man that could raise them spiritually. That was the role of Christ. Don't get sidetracked into just focusing on the miracles. Focus on the God behind them. What an amazing story. I'm going to go ahead and wrap it up. That way I just don't keep rambling, because I love this story. One of my favorites. And it's just even the way it's told is so simple, yet so powerful in its message and its impact and its implications and its theology. What an amazing story. And I'm going to quit rambling, and we're going to close this up, and I will catch you again on the next lesson.